Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's time once again to grab your gear, put on your sales cap. We're going to go out into the ocean, see if we can tag along in our little dinghy here with Joe Bergman, former editor of C Magazine. He talks about Pacific yachting. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much. And I'm welcoming Jim Bergman. What's your title of your company again?
Jim Bergman Construction.
Construction. Yep. Okay. Now, your construction includes everything on land and at sea.
Yep, I've done a lot of boat work.
Oh, good. Tell us about this one boat that you found that was everything on the outside was put inside, and it was sitting on a trailer, and you got it pretty good price, and you worked on that for how long did you work on it?
The first boat I had was a 28-foot boat. That one had been on a trailer in San Diego, and I wound up doing a bunch of motor work on that.
Yeah.
But after we lived on that for about 6 months, my wife said, buy a house or get a bigger boat. I found some I could afford, which was about $8,500. And this was a Kenny Hill wood boat, plank on frame. And the guy who owned it had given it to his nephew to fix. And his nephew took everything from the outside, the rails, the lights, all the rigging, put it on the inside of the boat so that he could paint it. But at that point, he lost interest and just used it as an apartment. So I was able to pick up the boat really cheaply and strip the hull, and then wound up basically rebuilding most of the boat using a lot of that West System epoxy and new hoses on the engine, redoing cabinets, redid the whole inside. And we lived on that boat for about 3.5 years.
How long was it again?
It's 44 feet.
44 feet. That made a big difference over that first one, your 28-footer.
Yeah, the first one was a 28-footer, but it had a 4-foot deck extension. So it was actually a 24-foot boat, 8 feet wide, with a 4-foot deck extension. So a 24-foot boat cabin is about the size of a minivan. So if you tried to live in a minivan, that's about what that boat was.
Now, how long ago was this?
That was 1995, so I guess I would have been like late 20s, You tend to accept a lot of inconvenience at that age when you're looking for adventure.
On the 44-footer then, okay, how did you get started on that? Everything was taken off the outside and you had to put everything out there and get started.
Basically we stripped the hull down first, and we did that in the marina because I had never done it before, and I thought I'm going to save money on.
Now, when you say stripping for our guests, you are meaning, what are you stripping?
So the paint on the outside of the hull was cracked. When paint's cracked on a boat, you basically have to take it off completely and start over. So you put chemical stripper on it, it bubbles up, and you use a scraper and scrape it off. And if you get that on your skin, it's like a pretty aggressive chemical. So it's causes pain. It'll burn your skin off if you don't wash it off right away.
You're stripping your skin off, too.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable process.
Yeah.
But we painted that on, and then the paint would bubble up. We'd scrape it off, and then we'd also combine that with heat guns and sanders, electric sanders, until we got it down to the wood, to where we could start doing primering and painting. And the old way of doing that was to thin the primer down with a thinner, and that would allow the primer to penetrate into the wood. Then we would build up several coats of that, and then we would actually add the primer to the paint, and we'd put a few coats of that on so that it would stick really well. Then we'd continue with the paint after that. So use a real thin nap roller, like a foam roller. We'd roll it on, and then we would use a brush to strike it off, and you could almost make it look like it was sprayed. And that can be done on cabinets. It can be done on the inside of the boat. It's a real good technique.
The inside?
Yeah, you could do it on the inside of the boat.
You repeat the whole process.
Yeah. But using a thin nap roller, like a foam roller, and then striking it off with a brush allows some of the nicer marine paints, like Pettit paints, to actually achieve a finish. It'll flow out and almost look like you sprayed it with a spray gun.
That's a brand. Pettit is, right?
Pettit is a brand. You get it Westport.
Now, once you've got the finish outside and inside and everything, start with the condition of everything inside the various locations within the boat.
So it had a cabin forward, so a sleeping quarters forward, sleeping quarters aft. It was what they called an aft cabin style. It's like something called a Grand Banks.
Okay, no, right there, cabin sleeping forward, that's in a V shape.
Yes,
there's a V. We can let everybody know what we're talking about here.
Yeah, V berth up front. So the best way is to actually put your head toward the wide side and put your feet up in the V. Definitely the more comfortable way of doing it.
Yeah.
And if they're adventurous, I guess you could sleep two people up there, but it's tight, at least in the foot area. And there was also there was a head, so bathroom for boat is a head with a shower and a toilet in the forward part of the boat. Then as you move toward the back of the boat, there was a kitchen lower down at about the same level as that V berth.
When you say kitchen, it's not like we normally think in a house, a kitchen. It's a space of an area in the middle of the boat or toward the back of the boat.
Yeah, it would be
cooking utensils and everything.
Yeah, it would be much smaller, probably something like you would see in a motorhome or in a trailer. And probably a lot of the technology would actually cross over to trailer technology, except when you have it on the water, it needs to be made out of something that doesn't corrode.
Yeah.
Anytime you put machinery or metal or appliances or anything near water, it takes a beating because you got salt in the air and all that. So most of the boat stuff is always going to be a lot more expensive, even though it may look the same as something that would go in a trailer or an RV or a motorhome. It's going to be a lot more expensive because the materials have to withstand the marine environment.
Sure. Even I think a lot of the RVs and trailers and things like that, they reflected many decades ago on boats to give them ideas of how they were going to redo or reinvent or manufacture RVs and things like that. Even though there was a big difference, everything began with boats anyway.
It did, yeah. Boats would have been around, I think, before RVs or trailers or motorhomes.
Well, they were a little bit before that, yeah.
Yeah. But they're all dealing with that same,
sure,
those same restrictions as far as lack of space and not having a lot of power.
In the shape of the vessel or the RV, sure, whatever case you're talking about. When you're out on the ocean, that boat has to be in a certain shape and everything. And the RVs and things, they could be more square or oblong or whatever. And
yeah, they're more like a big box, whereas a boat is shaped almost more like a giant football.
Yeah.
Pointy on the ends, the back may be chopped off. Some of them actually are pointy on the back too. And then fat in the middle. But there are no real straight lines in a boat. So when you're putting cabinets in, when you're working on the boat, everything has a curve to it or it's a funny shape. So that really causes a lot of challenges
when you're constructing things. But the hull itself is shaped as a half round.
Yes.
And so when you're putting things, like I was mentioned earlier, cabinetry and everything in the kitchen and even the beds and things like that are the...
Everything has to be custom built, and it really takes a craftsman that's skilled to be able to make those. You can't just take I do a lot of house construction, everything relatively square, so we can just take square boxes and screw them together. With a boat, you can't do that because every boat is a different shape. And you have to build everything from scratch. So it definitely takes a lot more skill.
Now, you've done both sail and power, and with both, you have to consider, even with a sailboat, a motor most often.
As with sailing, the wind's always coming from the direction that you want to go towards.
Right.
So sailboats are really, a lot of them motor about 70% of the time. Mm-hmm. If you're crossing the ocean and you have a wind on the beam or something, you might be able to sail most of it. But if you're trying to get out of the harbor, the wind's blowing into the harbor, and when you come back into the harbor, it's blowing out of the harbor. So you're pretty much running the engine most of the time. And so they've said that sailboats, actually, you would think they would be cheaper because you're using the wind, but they said that they actually probably spend more on sailboats as far as hardware and sails and cables and all the stuff that goes along with it they spend more than you do on a motorboat.
Oh, yeah. Say a 30 or 40-foot sailboat. The sails alone, you would have, basically, you would have two sails. But most people nowadays in a boat that size and everything, my God, you'd have all kinds of sails prepared to go in different directions and different winds and sure. things like that. You might be carrying 4 to 6 other sails.
Yeah. And when we used to race, we would carry at least, have a mainsail that's always pretty much the same.
Yeah.
Somebody's asking how many sails on a boat that size. Would you have 2 sails? How often do you have to change them? Once a year, once every 10 years? How long does the sail last?
So it really depends on the conditions that you have it in.
Where you're sailing from, and then the conditions.
Where you're sailing from, where you're sailing to. But there's people who sail continuously, like people who are crossing oceans. And they may only change, if you're using a sail continuously, you may only change it every couple of years. So you can get a lot of use out of it. If you're someone that's only sailing on the weekends, a sail could last 15, 20 years.
Nowadays.
And what's a sail cost? I guess you could go to a sail maker, somebody that takes the cloth. And
you could go to a sail maker. There's people who race boats who like to change their sails a lot, and they want the new technology. And so they usually will change their sails more often, and those used sails are available for sale at a place like Minnie's Yacht Surplus in Newport. I'm sure most major boating centers have somebody who will sell that. And that's a much cheaper way to do it. You could go and have a sail made, but I would imagine on a 40-foot boat, having a mainsail made could be $10,000. You could probably buy a used sail for a 40-foot boat for $1,000. I've been out of it for a little bit, so I might be off a little bit.
And last question, somebody has to put it up, or are you enough of a sailboater that you can put a sail up yourself for a 40-foot boat, that you can rig it and pull it up?
So everything is done by leverage on a boat, because a sail that size on a 40-foot sailboat, you could put it up with one person, but you would use a winch. So you would use mechanical advantage to raise and lower it and to pull it in, because there could be 1,500 pounds of force on the rope that's holding the sail if you're in a strong wind.
So I don't know if you saw the earlier episode that Joe did, but we had a guy come in who tried to race around the world. He went in this Vonda Challenge or whatever.
Oh, wow.
He only went halfway, and his sail mast snapped.
Yeah.
And he's in the middle of the ocean.
Snap. It pulled out of the hull.
It pulled out of the hull, yeah.
Wow. The deck.
Yeah.
So there's a big hole in the top of the deck, too. And he's not a young guy, and he's sitting there out there trying to figure out, how am I going to cover the hole? He had to cut off the rigging so the mast go, so it didn't come bang into the boat. And then what do you do? But earlier, he did a film. They showed it at the Newport Beach Yacht Club and the Newport Beach Film Festival.
Sure, sure.
Pretty harrowing. But yeah, he was out there trying to change the sail himself earlier.
That gives you an idea of the forces that sail can produce.
Yeah.
He was off New Zealand.
Yeah. He probably had a boat that was built fairly sturdy if he was planning on going around the world.
Oh, yeah. But
like a million-dollar boat or something. Yeah. All sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Sure.
Whether you're planning on it or not, if you're going around the world or even for any long distance, I don't care how well it might be built, there's always going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Boats, some minor, some major.
Boats require constant work. So if you boat for an hour, plan on working on it for 2 hours. That's how boats are.
And can you tell us how you got started in this? What were you sailing as a kid? This guy was sailing ever since he was a teenager.
Yeah. So I started sailing when I was about 12 years old. I grew up in West Africa.
I got to stop you. West Africa. Yes. You're the first person that's been in here in 15 years that grew up in West Africa.
Yeah. I was born in Colorado. When I was 8 years old, my parents got involved with social church type work, and my dad took our family to West Africa. So 3 kids.
Which country?
Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast. Yeah,
okay.
So it would have been, it's next to Ghana. The equator runs right over the top of it. It's hot and humid all the time, 95 degrees and 100% humidity. So.
You're the only person in my life I've ever met who's been to the Ivory Coast. I know where the country is, the Gold Coast and the Ivory Coast and Ghana and all those places right around there.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful country, tropical.
Gambia, another country.
But it's third world. It's like I grew up in a slum there. It's very similar to Tijuana, but not as nice. And
I'm sorry to laugh, but yeah, Tijuana, but not as nice.
Yeah, I lived there for 8 years, but that's where I learned to sail. Yeah, I started racing, I guess it would be similar to a 14-foot Lido type boat. And then I crewed a few times on a 40-foot sailboat, and that's how I started out learning.
You also crewed on a Transpac.
So later on during my boating career, I had the chance to do the Transpac on a 47-foot boat, Windwalker. And I usually get on boats because I'm able to fix things.
Yeah.
So it's a...
Now, just so everybody knows, the Transpac is from here, California, to Hawaii, 2,200 miles, 2,222 or something like that.
Yeah, we were in something called the cruiser class, which means we weren't really trying to win the race, but we were fishing and drinking and having fun and kind of generally... trying to point
just toward, getting across
to, trying to point towards Hawaii. Yeah.
And how long does it take to go? I have no concept of how long
it takes.
I think we were
on the ocean for 17 days.
Wow.
Which is a long time.
Now a racing vessel in that race, about 10 days.
So 12. Someone with a whole lot more money than me that can buy a boat that goes really fast, and these boats actually plane, so they get up out of the water and they're on a plane. Those guys are trying to win the big trophies that Rolex puts in their ads in a magazine or whatever. These guys will do it in 5 days.
5 days? Oh,
yeah.
I didn't realize they were that fast, though.
And a multi-hole, I don't know, someone would have to look up the record, but I'm sure that a catamaran, trimaran, I think Richard Branson probably set the record for that.
Yeah.
We'll do it quicker than that a lot of times. But and then, of course, it all depends on the weather. It could take them 8 days if the wind's not great.
And what's that like to be out in the water in the middle of nowhere? Literally.
You know, it pretty much, one thing that was interesting was it's the only time I have allergies. And the only time I've ever been completely clear and not had allergies was when I was right in the middle of the ocean.
Okay, all right.
But it was pretty much 15 feet. If you've seen... What's that movie about the storm where they all came together and
all these kids or something on this boat and something, what was it called?
Yeah, the ultimate storm or something like that.
Yeah, I don't remember it either.
I'll find
it.
The perfect storm.
That's exactly it.
So I was looking for that. I wanted 40-foot waves.
You wanted it?
Yeah. I wanted to see big waves and I wanted a lot of wind. It was a little bit disappointing in that respect. It was more 15-foot waves, pretty much 15-foot surf, pretty much all the way across.
And your boat was what size?
47 feet.
47. Okay.
So it was quite comfortable. You're stabilized when the sail's up, and you can't use the motor because it's a race. Luckily, the wind came from a good direction. I think that time of year, they know that the wind comes from a favorable direction.
And I got to ask one other question I've never asked before, but I've never been out of the ocean in a boat of any kind.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd get seasick. I'm assuming that everybody gets seasick in those kind of ways. How do you sleep? You just get used to the old sailors who went around the world in the 1800s? They just got used to bouncing up and down?
I think so. And the boat is on an angle all the time.
Yeah.
So you're always, luckily my bed was on the side on the angle that was facing toward the water, so I didn't roll out of bed. But, yeah, I think you just get used to it. I used to, when I raced 40-foot boats, I was in charge of the spinnaker. So when the spinnaker came down, I would go down below, and I had to stuff that spinnaker into a bag.
And tell me.
And that's when you normally would get sick. So
okay.
I got over my seasickness pretty quickly.
And I'm going to sound stupid, but where's the spinnaker?
From that. So the spinnaker is a completely different sail. I may be jumping around, but it's the big, colorful sail that you would normally see on the front of a boat when it's going downwind. So it's like a giant sheet. It gathers a tremendous amount of wind, and it only really works well when the wind is directly behind you.
Joe's trying to draw me a diagram here.
Yeah, when the wind is directly behind you is when that works the best. And the least favorite job is usually working that spinnaker. But I was a small guy, so they put me up on the front of the boat, and I was in charge of getting it up, taking it down. Then I had to jump inside the boat and stuff it into a bag, when it came down, and then you get it ready to put up again if the boat needs it. So because of that, I got over my seasickness. But even on the long voyage, we're talking about going on the Transpac, I still got a little bit seasick because you're days and days of days. I wound up wearing one of the transdermal patches, really helped.
Did they work? Okay.
And after about 5 days, it fell off, and I kind of endured it for about 3 days, and one of the ladies said, you need to get another patch back on. You just look like you're about to die. So I put another patch on. I was fine. We had a doctor on the boat, luckily, an older doctor, and he had all the proper stuff. But yeah, I would think that I think it would take a few passages to get to the point that you would completely lose your seasickness.
For one voyage, yes, but regardless, there's always going to be a time when someone that never gets seasick might get seasick.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Joe? Do you get seasick out there? You've been.
I have, coming from San Diego on about a 30-foot boat, power boat, and I'm coming. We were just out of San Diego, headed up toward Dana Point and everything, and I had a tuna sandwich before that.
That's the secret.
That was probably a mistake.
I think that was what caused my seasickness because I've never really been seasick. And when I was in the Coast Guard on the large amphibious planes that we would use for searches and things like that,
right.
I never got seasick on those. A couple times I got close, but I remember one, and on those which are no longer used by the Coast Guard, they use better planes now. But anyway, we were coming back from a long search, and a long search in one of the amphibious planes I'm referring to, the Albatross, you could go for 12, 15 hours. We were out there for about 10 or 12 hours, and we came in, landed, rolled over toward where we tie up our planes and everything, and I jumped out of the plane, went over to the ball field, and barfed.
All right. So I shouldn't feel bad if I don't feel good on a boat.
No, but just make sure that don't put it in your mind. You're going to get.
Is there a trick? I know we're going down
not
an
really.
Awkward thing here. To anything you can do? People say don't look at the horizon or don't follow the waves going up and down. I've heard that.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of things that are said, but they may not work for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Some people can lay down and close their eyes and it helps. Usually going down into the boat and reading a book would be like the worst thing to do. But like you said, looking at the horizon and trying not to just look at the boat when everything else is moving.
Because it's that movement of seeing it going up and down.
And driving the boat. I would prefer driving the boat, piloting the boat. But even that, depending on just how rhythmic the waves might be and things like that, then that gets to you.
So why would you want to be in 40-foot waves? Now, you'd never sleep. Nobody can sleep.
Nobody wants to get into those.
He said.
Likes them, yeah. But,
my risk meter is probably broken, but yeah. But no, I think it would be an adventure. People do it, and they live through it, and so obviously it can be done. But I think you would want to be prepared.
What's a big wave? I don't even know. If it's that as big as they get, or do they get 100 foot or 55?
Yeah, they could go 100 feet. South Pacific, I guess, has big waves. I'm not an expert on it in any sense, but I think if there was some kind of storm, and of course, if you're going around the
Cape Good Hope or something.
Right,
both the capes are very dangerous.
What is that, Terra Fuego or whatever?
Yeah.
Then
Jelland Straits, they used to call it.
I think that's where the seas come together, and then, of course, you get really huge waves. But probably if they're coming from one direction and they're fairly regular, it's probably easier. I'd say the biggest waves I've been in are maybe 25 feet maybe would be the biggest ones. And you got to keep your eye on them.
Oh, yeah. And you don't
turn your boat over.
Don't go heading into them and things like that necessarily. Sometimes you have to, but usually you're angling into a wave or whatever.
All right. Liveaboard. We only got a couple minutes to talk the liveaboard story. That was what this was supposed to be about. Instead, you get into the Transpac and 40-foot waves. I can't believe that. And living in West Africa. Talk about an exotic life here.
Yeah. It's easy to get off subject, but... So I lived aboard for 17 years. I thought it would be adventurous. I also thought it would be inexpensive. Definitely the adventure thing played out. It was fun. It was adventurous. It's not necessarily a cheaper way to live like a lot of people think. There's always something to fix on a boat. There's a lot of costs. There's cleaning costs, insurance. The government, of course, excuse me, finds a way, of course, to tax you. So there's still property taxes on a boat. Ah. It's actually can be considered a second home. So you could write that off on your taxes as a second home, but you also get taxed on it with property taxes. So that's something that a lot of people don't think about. They need to be pulled out. There's paint that's on the bottom of a boat that needs to be redone about every 3 to 4 years. It depends on the conditions that you're in. So you got to pull the boat out and repaint the bottom so that there's copper in the paint so that growth doesn't build up on the bottom. And it's got to be cleaned every month. So you clean all the growth off so it doesn't build up. And
there's all sorts of expenses, of course,
there's a slip rent, and a boat is typically not something that goes up in value. So it's
and you don't have enough room on
it, really.
When you get, regardless what size boat you may have,
it's a tight fit.
And they hook up with like water and power or something here.
So some people live on a mooring, which would just be like a mooring ball out in the harbor. And that would be the cheapest way to live, but you have no water or power, so you would have to deal with solar generator, and you'd have to haul your own water or go over to the dock and get it. If you're tied up to a dock, which would be the better option, especially if you have a girlfriend or wife or something, they prefer to be tied to a dock where they're hooked into water. So basically all the umbilical cords come in. You got water and power. We used to have cable. Now we don't need cable anymore because we have everything's wireless. And then a lot of times the sinks go directly, the drain water from the shower and the sinks will usually go directly into the harbor. And then the toilet goes into its own tank, which of course then you need to pay somebody to come and pump that out maybe once a week or every couple weeks. And that's usually about $40 a time.
The toilets are always a problem to deal with.
Yeah.
There's a lot of repair on them and things like
that. Especially if you have guests, they think that they're just like a toilet in a hotel and they put whatever they want down
80 pounds of toilet paper.
And then clog it up. And they're really no fun to repair. That's probably one of the less exciting
things. So what's
the
takeaway? Is it fun? Is it worth it? Is it an adventure everybody should try? Or is it when you get into it, you say, why did I do this?
I would say that
if
you're adventurous, you don't mind some discomfort and you want to try something different and you have a little bit of money, I think it's a great way to go. If you don't have any money, it's probably not the way to go because it's going to cost money to do it.
And that's the opposite. Everybody thinks it's cheap. I'm just going to live aboard a boat. I'm not paying rent per se.
Yeah, you probably get away with it for 6 months or a year, and then the cost of keeping up the boat will just overwhelm you. And a lot of boats get abandoned because people just can't afford them. And so it'd be good to have a little savings, a little nest egg, so that you can take care of problems and issues that might come up with the boat.
So, Joe, you ran a marina. Which marina did you run?
Newport Marina. It was right across from Hoke Hospital.
Okay, that's big.
It was fairly big, yeah.
How many boats roughly in there?
60, I think it was.
How of those 60, how many people are living on them?
I only had maybe 5 or 6 at a time.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want too many people living aboard because there was so much to be done for them and me. And we had showers and storage units in the major building there and things like that. Which is another thing. Regardless how big your boat is, you've got to find storage somewhere.
For your stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just not enough room on a boat unless you're really super downsized. But even then, you really need to have a storage unit or something.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And the story I've always heard, again, don't know much about this, is that Dana Harbor was higher, more liveaboards, because now they're dredging it up and redoing it. There was some uprising, some protests, some angry people because they're raising the fees. And they really want to get rid of those liveaboards. That's not what the... I'm not speaking for them, so I may have this wrong, but I believe they're trying to upgrade the marina and get away from this idea that people have lived there for years on some little tiny sand.
And it's true just about anywhere. I don't care how fancy your marina may be or anything. Somebody within a government agency or whatever says, okay, we don't want any more liveaboards. It's just selfishness of everybody. Some people want to live aboard. Some people don't want to live aboard.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a world I've always heard about. I had a fantasy when I was young. I thought this would be great. And my wife and I were just together, and I said, man, let's go.
Everybody's thought about it at one time or another.
Yeah.
You got you are doing interior construction and things of boats still.
So I currently have a boat that's 32 feet catamaran called the Glacier Bay with a Honda 250s. And so I've been redoing some of the inside of that boat.
But you would do this as commercially for other people.
But I have done it in the past, especially in 2008 when all the housing stuff slowed down. Actually, I was working on boats quite a bit back then. I don't typically do it as a trade at this time, unless I'm doing it for friends or for myself. But I did work on boats commercially for quite a while.
Yeah, cool. I think that's enough for right at this moment, but we'll get you back here and we'll talk a whole bunch about other stuff too.
Who else? Yeah. You covered three topics. I've never met anybody. You live aboard a boat. I know people do, but I've never met anybody that does. You were born in West Africa on the Ivory Coast. Never heard of that one. And you went out in the Trans-Pacific and were disappointed the waves were only 15 feet. three memorable moments.
It's been an adventure. I don't regret any of it.
And now you're on a podcast. That's an adventure.
Yep. Yep.
Jim Borgman, B-O-R-G-M-A-N, you are, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for having me, Joe.
Yeah. Thank you. Wow. Such casual conversation about some crazy adventures here. That's what you're going to get on Pacific Yachting as we explore the world of Taken to the Sea from the former editor of Sea Magazine right here on the one place you come to see all this, OC Talk Radio.